Welcome to the Burn Bag Podcast. My name is Ryan Rosenthal, joined as always by my co-host Andre Ganuela, and this is episode 5 of the Burn Bag's collaboration with the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center, where we've been featuring contributions to their 100 Ideas for the First 100 Days project.
In today's episode, we have two great ideas. The first one by Stephen Shapiro, who's a senior advisor to the Atlantic Council, where he talks about why we need to add a deputy DNI for domestic coordination. And we talk to Matthew Crouch, a senior U.S. Marine Corps fellow, and Clementine G. Starling, a deputy director of Forward Defense, about their idea about why we need to advance a multilateral security architecture in the Indo-Pacific.
Stephen Shapiro is a senior advisor at the Scowcroft Center and a private investor in the New York area. Stephen devotes much of his time to national and international security issues via the Atlantic Council and Business Executives for National Security. Now, while at BENS, where Stephen has been a member for over 35 years, he was the chair of the Task Force on Domestic Intelligence Reform, and he was the principal author of the 2015 study entitled Domestic Security: Confronting a Changing Threat to Ensure Public Safety and Civil Liberties, which has had a monumental impact at the FBI, DHS, and ODNI. Now, Stephen talks to us today about adding a DNI deputy director position for domestic coordination. Stephen begins by telling us what the issue is and why it's so important.
The thrust of the work, of the undone work, is this statement. And bear with me as I cheat, because I'm just going to read to you from the third paragraph of my piece, because it says it better than I can ad lib it. Let's stipulate that intelligence is the best tool we have to fight terrorism, whether abroad or even at home. While today over 20 agencies or entities do some form of domestic intelligence, there is no unified assessment of all the threats to domestic national security, no harmonized cross-agency mission package, no responsible officer to manage and deconflict between operating agencies, no way to enhance civil liberties protections and standardize their application across those entities, and no way to provide rational, unified congressional oversight. That's the problem. So I can't claim to having birthed the awareness of this problem. In reality, the 9/11 Commission did. And their main recommendation was to create a manager of the intelligence community. And that was the DNI. Now, unfortunately, the DNI was not fully empowered at the time of its creation. And Michael Allen's book is great for that. You should bring him on the show. And so it got much of what it needed, but not all of it. In fact, the way I describe it, it has all the responsibility without all the authority. And that's a bad recipe for success.
Stephen then provides us with his actual recommendation and the practical implications of how it's actually going to be implemented.
The central proposal that I am pushing is to create a deputy director for domestic coordination. And that person would address those problems that I just, that officer would address those problems that I just outlined. But we are still in stovepipe. We are still organized by function and not by mission. And the mission is the domestic national security landscape. We have to remember that while domestic violent extremism is today the issue on everybody's lips, and for obvious reasons, I mean, the 1/6 attack was horrific, it may or may not be the most significant domestic national security threat we have, even though everybody's saying it is. It's not necessarily. Perhaps cyber threats to our infrastructure are more significant. Perhaps cyber attacks on our institutions are more significant. Perhaps international criminal cartels cause more deaths. Perhaps, and I can go on, perhaps foreign terrorism is still a greater risk. Perhaps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? But we wouldn't know because on the domestic side, nobody's asking that question. Now, for contrast, on the foreign side, every year there's something called the threat assessment, annual intelligence threat assessment. In fact, it was released just a couple of weeks ago, and the unclassed version. And they get together with CIA, DIA, FBI, and who knows who else, under the coordination of the ODNI and the NSC, which is the right way to do it. And they look at the globe and how it affects us. And they say, okay, this is what's out there. These are the threats to us. These are their ranked priorities. Let's create a mission package to address them. Let's make sure CIA does this and that, and FBI does this and that, and DIA does this and that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Treasury participates, and energy participates, all those intelligence agencies. Then they come up with a resource package. If this is what we need budget, we need personnel. We need to make sure that nobody steps on each other's toes, no overlaps, no gaps. We don't want it to look like a junior high school baseball team where the ball falls between the left and the center fielders, or worse, they bump, they slam into each other as they're catching the ball and nobody gets it. And that package then goes to Congress and says, can you authorize money for this, please? This is what we're going to do. Congress has a streamlined oversight, authorization, and appropriate structure with respect to foreign intel. Well, obviously, it doesn't with respect to domestic intel. We'll get to that. And so presses the button, gives them the money. It's called the National Intelligence Program. It's very nicely unified. It's got a ribbon. Goes back to the DNI, and they say, okay, go do it. And then the people who oversight that are the same guys who took it in to begin with. So they have some knowledge as to what's supposed to be going on because their intelligence, the staff there are intelligence professionals. And the members on those committees, Senate and House Intel, do this for a living. So they get it. Okay, let's contrast that with the domestic side. Nothing. And then nothing, followed by nothing. And then a mess. Okay, so the nothing is that there is no annual threat assessment, as I opened up with. There is no annual mission package. There is no cross-agency deconfliction or assignment of missions. There is no whole pie of proposed activities to deliver to Congress so it can see the whole thing, which it needs to in order to intelligently oversight it, to understand it, authorize it, appropriate it, and then oversight it, doesn't exist. There's no whole pie. So they're delivering up slices of pies to all these different committees and subcommittees. And you've heard this before. There are 92 or more committees and subcommittees that oversee DHS alone. DHS alone, right? So the fragmentation in Congress only confirms, enhances, and ensures fragmentation on the domestic, on the actual enterprise side for the operators, because they have that subcommittee to deal with rather than somebody who sees the whole pie. And somebody who's seeing the whole pie can spot the gaps or the overlaps, can see the underfunding. Maybe they'll disagree with the prioritization. I mean, that's what the lawmakers are allowed to do. And, you know, and out of that comes some rational behavior.
Stephen concludes by addressing the civil liberties implications and gives us his bottom line as to why a domestic coordinator is so necessary.
There are all these ancillary things, but they all flow from the main recommendation that there be a domestic coordinator, not a spy master, not urging more spying. I'm urging more smart bureaucracy. And at the same time, we can raise the standard of civil liberties. How? Every one of these 20 plus agencies does their own civil liberties approach. They read the books, they listen to the attorney general, they read case law, they figure out what they should be doing, they train their people, they oversight it. You got 20 different standards. There should be the highest standard, one standard, the best. That's something that office can do as well. We wrap up with the line I've been using ever since I wrote the report: the measure of our success will be a more safe nation.
Our next idea, advancing a multilateral security architecture in the Indo-Pacific, is by Matthew Crouch and Clementine Starling. Now, Matthew is a lieutenant colonel in the military and had a long and illustrious career serving in Afghanistan and Iraq. Clementine Starling is the Deputy Director of Forward Defense and is also a resident fellow of the Transatlantic Security Initiative here at the Atlantic Council. She's done a range of research that has looked at great power competition with China and Russia. She's looked at deterrence and U.S. force posture and transatlantic security, and has looked and currently leads a lot of the work on defense policy and European security practice areas.
Matt and Clementine's idea is advancing a multilateral security architecture in the Indo-Pacific region. They begin by discussing this issue and why it's so important.
So the issue that Matt and I wrote about is about advancing a multilateral security architecture in the Indo-Pacific. So as I think many of your listeners know, great power competition between China and the US is heating up, and it will continue to do so in the coming decades. And China really is the major long-term security concern and priority of the United States. President Biden recently called it extreme competition. So what we have written about is really the way in which the US and its allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific need to better organize to improve deterrence in the region and to mitigate against potential threats. And one way in which we kind of really think that it's important to do so is enhancing the bilateral arrangements that the US has right now with Indo-Pacific allies and partners, some of the security guarantees that exist already, but enhancing that further into kind of a more multilateral framework, which brings different existing allies in, new partners in, because this is a long-term challenge. And we think that the United States needs to become more creative and forward-looking in terms of thinking through what type of security arrangements could be sufficient to mitigate potential threats and uphold deterrence.
I'll start with sort of walking back just a little bit to add in terms of what Clementine had just said. There's an element of this that is about the stakes and the threat and the risk inherent in that. I think if we look at the Indo-Pacific, we can see that largely the future of development and industry and economy is going to be in that region. And at the same time, we see the Chinese on the rise, and I think legitimately seeking to displace the United States, but more importantly, the order that has been established, which the United States has been the head. So if you think in terms of the term of art, the Thucydides trap and the rise of one power and another, I think it would be great to see a kind of transition that we saw after the Second World War from one power to another in a peaceful manner. I just don't know that that's realistic, given the desires that the People's Republic of China seems to be expressing, that the Communist Chinese Party, or the Chinese Communist Party rather, has for a future order in which they are the leader. And I think the degree to which that would end up being a malign influence on the way we do business, right? So the stakes are driving us in that direction. And then I think timing is everything, right? So if we're at a point where the confluence of these events and the conditions make the risk decision very stark, right? The PRC is a rising and revisionist power that even 10 years ago, there was some ambiguity around what the intent was. Today, we see them not only increasingly confident, but more bellicose and more capable. There's this growing influence that they have, but they're aware as well, I think, of some potential limitations that they face, not only in terms of where they go and what that does to world opinion, but some of the demographic challenges that are looming. And I think we've arrived at what in the naval service we would term, Fennell's coined this term, decade of concern, right? This moment where the PRC is looking out across a 50-year time frame, and they've calculated that they're able to take the actions that they want to take and get away with it because they have a certain relative strength. And then they could present a fait accompli and have enough cooling off period where the world could adjust to that, or a 19-year time frame based off of what they learned from Tiananmen Square, that the world will be ready to welcome them back into a fold that they are then a major leader in. And, you know, that window is 2020 to 2030, if you were to peg it, let's say, to the 2049 anniversary. So I think a lot of the conditions are leading us to have a heightened sense of awareness and a heightened degree of concern that now and over the next 8 or so years, there's a higher likelihood than we've seen in the past for folks to act. Right? So that brings a sense of urgency. And then in terms of the steps and how we go about doing that, and our recommendation to, as you said, reinvigorate the Quad, I think that is one conception of it. It's clear that the U.S. can't take a go-it-alone strategy for a variety of reasons, but one of our core strengths is certainly our ability to work with allies. And I think you can develop a lot of risk mitigation by being cooperative in your approach to security in any region. And we've seen the benefits of that over time with NATO, but we don't have a similar structure, even though we can see the utility that that would bring in the Indo-Pacific. So if we're going to engage, as Clem said, in the place where the threat is at, where the PRC are physically resident, if we're going to do that, we're going to need the Indians, and we're going to need the Australians and the Japanese and the South Koreans. And that list is not in any way meant to be exclusive, because I think to the extent that it's more inclusive, it's a greater deterrent. And a lot of this I see as being about deterrence, presenting a calculus that doesn't allow the CCP to get to a point where they decide in favor of action and make any attempts to upset what we've come to enjoy as the rules-based order.
Matthew and Clementine now outline what exactly their recommendation is.
We're recommending that the United States partners and allies can bolster deterrence by engaging in an effort to build a multilateral cooperative security architecture. As we've talked about, much as we've seen NATO serve as a stabilizing feature in Europe, a similar structure or forum in the Indo-Pacific could help bring stability and deterrence in that critically important theater. And I think part of the core part is bringing together like-minded nations and consorts. So the Quad could be one such vehicle to build cooperative security arrangements. The Quad right now is an informal strategic dialogue between the US, Japan, Australia, and India. But we see obviously key regional Indo-Pacific allies such as Vietnam, South Korea, the Philippines, and others all have an important kind of part to play. Each nation's different in terms of their relationship with the United States and with each other in terms of the bilateral levels of cooperation within the Indo-Pacific. But we think such a multilateral structure could help align and organize regional security, improve situational awareness, could be focused on sharing plans, aligning strategies, and really building trust as a kind of foundational component between these allies and partners. And I think, more and more as the threat landscape evolves and changes in the Indo-Pacific, it will become more of an imperative to really have a vehicle or a forum to share threat assessments and coordinate policies to effectively deter Chinese coercion in the Indo-Pacific.
Is this recommendation viable, and will the United States be able to bring together all of its crucial partners in the Indo-Pacific region? Matt and Clem address these questions next.
I think it's quite viable, and I think it's viable particularly over time. I mean, I think you're highlighting one of the challenges of building any alliance, which is how do you bring the various groups, the various nations together into a common body with common interests. But I think India is a good example of how the dynamic strategic security environment is changing, and that's changing their needs and also their response to the greater geopolitical competitive environment. I think what that tells us is the biggest factor in the overall picture is going to be the behavior of the People's Republic of China. And it, as I mentioned before, our reaction to an increasing threat, and I think across the region, whether you look at the debt trap diplomacy or the wolf warrior diplomacy or the encroachment on EEZs, increasingly the PRC is pushing and creating tension in a manner that indicates to these other countries that some form of cooperative security or arrangement that they may not have considered in the past would be beneficial to them and to the region. So I think that in terms of one of the partners wanting to remain non-aligned, it's a variable scenario where, depending on how great the threat is, the structure that we're recommending could take different forms, more and less formal, based off of how the coalition sees the threat. And if the threat continues to increase, that'll only drive us to have tighter relationships. And again, India is a good example because you can see that they're reaching out and bolstering their relationship with other nations, not just with the U.S. as they did with the information sharing agreement from last October, but with Japan and with South Korea. And I think that, again, right, that's not an exhaustive list, but across the region, nations are looking out and trying to decide how they're going to manage the rising China. And I think with key U.S. leadership in key areas, we can move that all in the right direction to present a series of arrangements or agreements that show the PRC that there is a benefit to playing by the established set of rules, and to do so is in the benefit of everyone involved.
Matthew and Clementine now address whether this Indo-Pacific security architecture can go from dialogue to actual meaningful cooperation.
In the short term, the U.S. really will have to balance between the security environment in which we're facing, but also not forcing partners into a choice that they're not willing to make. There are nuances here in the region in terms of the historical relationships that different countries have with China, their geographical locations, different kind of concerns. But what we think is that in the long term, the security imperative will bear out, and it really requires more cooperation, and it requires more formalized cooperation. So this is kind of a long-term vision of building a multilateral security arrangement or organization, whatever you want to call it. I think the steps that are requirements to kind of get there are, the first is U.S. leadership in terms of counter-influence. The U.S. can bring foundational capabilities needed to make any multilateral security arrangement competitive. And the U.S. needs to demonstrate its commitment to the region and the political will to be there in the long term. The second is really a dedication to the concept of a free and open Indo-Pacific. Alignment around that as a concept should be a primary goal in terms of protecting nation sovereignty and their resources. The third kind of focus of this arrangement should really be on enhancing shared situational awareness in a multilateral way, instead of simply in kind of bilateral contacts. Because, I think I wouldn't want to downplay the importance of kind of building shared situational awareness, shared understandings of the threat landscape. That's really critical. We can't work together operationally or strategically without that as a foundational block. But then in terms of kind of the fourth and fifth steps, the fourth would be really routinizing operational cooperation in the security context. So building on the already robust periodic cooperation that's ongoing, moving that to more of a kind of multilateral or bilateral training event schedule to kind of a continuous multilateral naval presence, for example, is something that such an arrangement could see. And then the final thing that we think is important is to also include potentially European partners, particularly France and the UK. The interests of those countries, those core European countries who already have a significant presence in the region, significant maritime capabilities, the US should really be encouraging those allies to kind of play a more significant role.
Well, I'll say yes, right? And we're proposing something that over time and given the opportunity, and none of it can happen overnight, right? It's going to have to be incremental and iterative in nature, and it's got to be agile and responsive to the actual environment. But over time, what we're suggesting is that we would move towards something that was more than collaborative, that was in fact cooperative, that would involve Article 5 type guarantees for the security of others.
Is the United States at risk of overextending itself? Matt and Clem address this criticism next.
I think given the alternative of not engaging and not moving towards a multilateral approach or a balance to China as we see it rising, we should say that we go as far as is necessary to maintain the freedom of navigation on the seas and the rules-based order as we've come to understand it, right? We're talking about the defense of a system that has raised more people out of poverty and spread more freedom and prosperity than ever before in human history. I think in some ways we're a bit desensitized to how unique of a time we live in because many of us have never experienced anything else at this point. So I think we could go a long way. And there is a risk of being overextended, but that risk always existed. And it's going to continue to exist. So the question is, how do you go about mitigating it? And as I mentioned earlier, in the past, we maybe had the ability to go it alone. We might have just said, hey, let's expand the force to enhance the presence that we need to balance this situation out. But I think now, and again, part of the urgency is that we don't have that available to us. If it's not unaffordable, I think it's probably unfeasible for a variety of reasons. And so we have to look to our partners and how do we be creative to offer some sort of hedge against that risk. And I'm a big believer that whether it's under the auspices of being led by the U.S. or whether it's other partners doing things in partnership on their own, all of those can be additive. And I think it shifts that adversary calculus quite dramatically when they're forced to factor the combined strength of all the partners and the allies as a whole. So Clem mentioned one of the things that we could do is the operationalization on a routine basis of a kind of combined joint naval task force, right? I think that first fleet concept that was floated late last year probably has a lot of benefit to it. You could imagine a standing coalition where the partners were always engaged in a mission together, perhaps even with rotating leadership. You know, we've had the French, for example, lead a strike force in the operations out of the Mediterranean already in the past. So it's not without precedent for us to have an ongoing mission where our partners go ahead and take the lead. So we could conduct counter-piracy operations together, or HADR, humanitarian type mission set. Really, I think there is a wide swath of opportunity for us to work with other nations out there in the Indo-Pacific under that concept of a first fleet that could show the PRC that we're here, that we're going to bolster presence, and we're going to do so in a way that is creative and affordable for the United States. It doesn't just have to rely on leveraging the Pacific fleet into different areas, but capitalizes on the Australian Royal Navy, for example. Again, there are a number of ways that we could do that, bolster interoperability, create a truly viable force that is strategic in its nature because of the messaging that it's sending and the locations that it's able to patrol and do so on a regular basis. And that's just, I think, one small example of how we might consider moving forward with the Quad or Quad Plus and this kind of multilateral security structure. And I think it's, right, for the opponent, that's a fairly sobering thing. And I think because of that, it's a pretty stabilizing proposition.
To answer your question, kind of, is the U.S. at risk of overextending itself? As Matt said, that's always a risk. The reality is the U.S. is a global power with global security challenges. And I think the Biden administration is really facing that right now, that, you know, the decision to pull out of Afghanistan, in part, you know, that's to free up resources to focus on what, you know, the Department of Defense is really sharpening, which is a focus on strategic competition with China in the long term, and continuing to be able to balance that with a competition with Russia as well. What we're recommending is, you know, a path to determine those trade-offs. And I think Matt and I both agree that one of the US's great strengths, probably one of its core strengths, is its alliance network, its relationships with allies and partners. And that actually allows for more flexibility for the US to be able to prioritize elsewhere if it has allies and partners to rely on. And the value of security, of more formalized security architectures, of ongoing dialogue, of bringing allies together, is not just for the US to be the leader at the table, but to improve cooperation and understanding among the US's allies and partners, and having that be more routine, having that be more formalized, actually enables the US to kind of free up its resources to be nimble, to be able to focus on multiple challenges at the same time, because the reality is the US cannot be everywhere at the same time. So having great allies and partners to rely on, to kind of be those security exporters in key regions of the world, I think is critical, not just now, but more so in the future.
Thank you so much for joining us. This will be our last episode featuring contributions to the 100 Days, 100 Ideas initiative with the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. We'd like to thank Barry Pavel and Caroline Molterer for their support and their ideas as we conceptualize this miniseries. We'd also like to thank all of our guests who appear on the miniseries, in addition to all of the authors who contributed to the 100 Days, 100 Ideas on the Atlantic Council's website. My name is Andre Gonuella, and you've been listening to the Burn Bag Podcast.
To hear other fascinating conversations, subscribe to the podcast and follow us on social media at Burn Bag Pod. Thank you for listening. This is the Burn Bag Podcast.